but it's most evident in construction, but it applies to any kind of Christian work if you really think about it. This is a picture that I got, a lithograph, and it's about, I could tell you the artist, but I had to look it up, about Nehemiah's work. And we all have been involved in some kind of construction, each of us, at various levels. Some of us may have been building, I grew up building hog pens. And there's a lot of work to a hog pen, mostly underground. You have to build it in a way that the hog don't go under it. And that takes quite a bit of work. But think about any kind of construction you've done. If you got your Bible, what are we? We're pretty much all in King James, right? Some got NIV or?
New King James.
New King James, okay. All right. Shortest man? I don't know.
Knee high.
Well, in that case, if you go by that, he would be. Yes. Knee high. Well, if we're all pretty much in different versions, I'm gonna read from this morning is the ESV, the English Standard Version. And let's just start today by reading the third chapter of Nehemiah. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred and as far as the Tower of Hanal. And next to him, the men of Jericho built, and next to them, Zakur, the son of Imri, built. The sons of Hanasseh built the fish gate. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them, Meremoth and the son of Uriah, son of Hakkas, repaired. And next to them, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, son of Meshechabel, repaired. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Barna, repaired. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord. Now, what does that mean? There's some there, right? Who were some of the folks against this? Have we seen anything about the Tekoites before? Yeah, they weren't the Tekoites. So there's something there, something else, and we'll get to that later, I think. All right. Jehoiada, the son of Pesha, and Meshullam, the son of Besadiah, repaired the gate of Yeshanah. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts and its bars, and next to them repaired Melatiah the Gibeonite and Jadon the Marathonite, the men of Gibeon and Mizpah, the set of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them, Uzel, the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths, repaired next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. So he's telling you all the things that these guys could do besides build a gate. So you're seeing by this that we're not, this is not a union job. We're not just letting people do what they're gifted at. We talk about in our church about shape, you know, your spiritual gifts. And sometimes we get confused that, well, that means that's all I can do is how I'm gifted. You have here an evidence of everybody pitching in, the whole community, to build it. Now, how were you raised? Did anybody here ever, have you ever been involved in what was called a barn raising? All y'all city folks? Have you once? Well, when my family moved into the community, my dad owned a adult beverage business in Atlanta, and my mother, a good Baptist lady, just could no longer accept the fact that she was receiving her money, her living, from the sale of intoxicating beverages. So they had a lot of, I guess you would call them discussions, late into the night throughout my lifetime. And finally, my dad relented and sold the business. And we relocated in Northeast Alabama in Lookout Mountain. And we moved into a little community called Shady Grove. There was a Shady Grove Baptist Church. And when my dad got ready to build his barn, everybody in the community came together, and in a day, his barn was built. I've never, you know, we didn't publicize that. It's just how they are. So I got to be a part of one of those one time, and everybody was doing their thing. And that's kind of the idea. Everybody's pinned in here. And it's easy in the third chapter to get lost in all those names, but I want you to see the point is building for unity. The community is rebuilding the wall. This is a group effort. The whole point of Nehemiah chapter 3 is that everybody is involved. And then he's telling you where the walls are being repaired through the first 15 chapters where we read. And then he's going to concentrate on the eastern wall in the last part. And I've got a diagram here that I had to turn sideways. And I've also got a picture, and we'll look at both of those here in a moment, to kind of help us because it's easy to get lost in all these names. So I think this one probably shows the best. Look if you can, see if you can find some of those gates. We talked about the sheep gate, and it's up at the very top here. That's where we started, right? Nehemiah chapter 3. The priest, wasn't it the sheep gate that the priest put together and they dedicated? Okay, so it would be here, the very top. And then we start going around, and these are the different words, the different men, Hanel, Mia, the fish gate here. And they're working their way around, and you can see that they're talking about building the building of this wall. Okay? I would imagine there are not any reference to towers here. The towers, I'm sure, were added later.
Oh, okay.
The whole point here was just to get up the wall. Yeah.
But it mentions
did it? Which one? Does it mention in chapter 3? Okay. Verse 1. Read to me. Okay, this is the Tower of Mia. Okay. Yeah, it's here. It's the Tower of Mia, Tower of Miel. I'm working on it. What you can't see yet is that I actually don't own the rights to do that, but I'm getting them. And the company's from England, so I couldn't correspond with them as quickly, but it's the best picture of Nehemiah's wall I've ever found. And it kind of gives you the idea of how small everything is.
Did they later change the wall?
Well, they built on. Yes, they continued. There's a whole western expansion that happens in Nehemiah later, we'll see. And then, of course, and I've got some other things that I'm now, I don't know if y'all will have me a third time or a next time or whatever, but I mentioned to Mildred, I've been working and studying the idea of the believer as the Ark of the Covenant, as a type of the Ark of the Covenant. And so I've been looking into some things there, doing some study there too, and I found some pretty good slides for that. But it's hard to find these things because most everything, if it's about Jerusalem, it's either about David's Jerusalem or Solomon's Jerusalem or Jerusalem during the time of Jesus. This whole period of the Old Testament just gets jumped because it's not that significant usually because the temple that was built here isn't as pretty or as large or as the other times. Right, right. But that gives you an idea of how small and how, you know, these guys were really up against great enemies and how precarious their situation was. We think of Jerusalem and we think of a large area and of strong fortresses, but not during this time.
Do they mention how many acres
No, acres is a modern term. There's some distances, and we can get into some of that later. But yeah, it's nowhere. It's very small. Today, if you and I were to compare the current nation of Israel to an American state, it would compare to our smallest state, Rhode Island. And I don't know if you've ever been to Rhode Island. Yeah, it really is a small, small area. Yes, very easily. If you were to go to Israel today, what is called the Old City is where you would go. But still, Jerusalem, and that's why, imagine if you lived in New York City, or rather you lived in New Jersey, and there were people who lived in New York City who were shooting shells into your home. That's how, I mean, just a river dividing them, and that's the West Bank in Israel and then Gaza Strip in Israel, that's how it is today. But I thought this was the best thing I could find to help us as we look at those. But notice the idea that the community, everybody is working together to repair the wall and then the construction of the Eastern Wall. So let me get over there. So starting at verse 16 now. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk. Now, this is a different Nehemiah, remember? Remember we started, I showed you there were three Nehemiahs? And this is a different Nehemiah. Ruler of half the district of Bethzur, repaired to a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the official pool, and as far as the house of the mighty men. Okay, who are the mighty men? What are they talking about? Let's see if we can see any of these places now. Who's mighty men? Who are the mighty men? Yes, but there, when we see the phrase mighty men in the Old Testament, that's a particular group of people. Is it warm enough for you ladies? I'm fixing to melt. Which would be good if I could melt in certain spots. It's probably in Kings, I guess. David's warriors were referred to as the mighty men. And I'm trying to find. So I guess it's back in Samuel, 2 Samuel. Well, I won't take any more of our time. I'll look it up and get it for you next week. Where? No, that's a different. Yeah. Yeah. These are, when we're talking about Jerusalem and mighty men, these are the particular group of men who had been with David through everything. And there's an area in the scripture, and I'll find it, where it recounts how that David had slew a giant, but so had many of these mighty men. And they are a special group. And so, when we're referring to, notice how it said that first was David's grave and then the mighty men. They were kind of given the honor of being buried near him. Think about our Arlington. So this is a special area. It's not just something that is willy-nilly thrown out there as a term. So David's the grave. So here's the King's Garden, the Siloam Pool. So we're moving in a different direction now. How many of you have been to Israel? I know Rochelle has. Is there anything in your travels that you can tell us about that you learned about these gates? There's really nothing of this remaining in history Like you couldn't go today to Israel and they say this is the wall of Nehemiah. Only recently has there been an archaeological evidence of one of these walls being found as they continue to dig down and down. No. Now all this would be, all this, you know, you would have been above all this. The Temple Mount, yes, but it was expanded during Herod. So what you see today, let me see here. Well, and it probably, for what you saw, I'm sure it is. Yes.
It's 2 Samuel 23, verse 8. There are the names of them.
Once more, Madge, I'm sorry.
2 Samuel 23, verse 8.
Thank you. Right. Of course, I immediately, when you said that, I turned to 1 Samuel 23, verse 8. Right. I see why you stopped. Josheb Bashebeth. Go ahead. A Tachyonite. He was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 800 whom he killed at one time. So if you read that section, that shows you how that you hear of the wonderful exploits that David had as a warrior, but there's actually a great principle there that applies to Nehemiah as well, of what a great leader he was. He wasn't just someone who inspired others to go do great things, David. I mean, who could do them himself, but he inspired others to do them as well. And Nehemiah, in gathering this group of people together, you know, he's being much more productive than if he went to build the wall himself. This is one of those slides I was telling you about Jerusalem. And so this is the new city, the old city. Herod, this is the Temple Mount today. Well, not today, the Dome of the Rocks on it, but in the biblical times. And so what we're talking about, what we're looking at, is this very narrow area here. Okay? So what you, when you went to Jerusalem, yeah, all of this other, and then of course now there's more. But it was expanded. Right, right. But what we're talking about is just this area here.
So that's all that was there again.
Right, right. Because remember, it had been destroyed. Well, and because of the Dome of the Rock, any excavation in this area is highly dangerous and highly charged politically, so that there's great issue there. But of course, there are a group of Hasidic Jews today who are doing everything they can to bring back the not only temple worship, but of course, the third temple being built. And depending on how you define which temple they're going to build, there's no way you can have that temple and the Dome of the Rock existing together. One will have to go to make room for the other. And that'll be interesting how that happens in history.
There's only one temple that was actually designed by God Himself. The rest of them are just man's.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, Herod expanded. Let's see. Here are the sizes of the temples. And just to give you an idea, at the bottom here is the size of an American football field. Can I move that where you can see better, Miss Neal? Can you see it by now? Okay. And you've got Solomon's temple here. This is what the tabernacle looked like. And then see how much bigger Herod's temple? But then this is the temple called for in Ezekiel. So it's huge by comparison. So Nehemiah's temple would be somewhere between the size of the tabernacle and Solomon, the temple that we're dealing with now. It was nowhere near as grand as Solomon's temple, but it was a little larger than the old tabernacle. So everything in Jerusalem of Nehemiah's day would be much, much smaller. So.
I wonder they repaired it in 52 days.
Yes, it's, yeah, exactly. And it's so easy for us to see something like this, and we immediately think, by our terminology, you know, but the history of things, it's easy for you to walk in an area and think, well, everything that has always been as it is. But no, he had to work to get it there. So just this narrow section, and so what we were looking at before, much, much more is going to be built back here. Really a very small place. And yet it's the center of the universe, really, for religion. Here's the Pool of Siloam is way down here. Okay? So that's kind of on one end versus the Sheep Gate on the other. I'll give you an idea of a kind of a north-south reference. Okay?
What's on the south side?
The Pool of Siloam. Not directly, yeah, in the Dung Gate. Not directly south. It's not exactly north-south, but it would be the farthest point. And the King's Garden. Yes. Yeah, the Valley of Kidron. Yes, that's the valley. Yes. Yes. The Kidron Valley, you probably remember, probably have some pictures you took from there. Yeah. All right. Well, let's. Anybody got any questions on Nehemiah chapter 3? Anything that you read or anything in Nehemiah there? Yes. No, go ahead. Go ahead. There's a lot there. Yes, there's a lot there.
It starts with the Sheep Gate, which is the northernmost, that points to Christ.
Right. The door of the sheep, he says, right?
Then you have the Fish Gate, which is the next one, talking about fishes of men.
Right. Which would be right next to it there.
Talks about the old pass.
Old wine.
That we don't right. Stray from, you know, you stay in the old path in the valley gate. The picture of grace. But the one that gets me is, between the valley gate and then you have the Dung Gate.
Right.
And the Dung Gate's where you get rid of all the refuge.
Right.
And that's the picture of words.
Of hell. Right, the Valley of Gehenna.
Right, and then you have the Fountain Gate, which is your picture of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Or words when you get rid of all the bad things in your life.
Right, here's the gate of the fountain here. Hold on just a minute, Lee. Let me stop. If you can see here, we're actually talking about gates. It's hard to see on these, but here, this on this picture, this fountain gate that Lee was just talking about, you can actually see there's a gate there. So we're talking about areas that people would go through. So the Holy Spirit, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's the river from living water.
Right. It's up here.
Talking about horses, the symbol of war.
Right. Four horsemen of the apocalypse and such, right?
And it says these guys
Right. Yes. Remember, they're working with their sword tied to their belt. Yeah.
But then you have the east gate and then the inspection gate. Inspection gate, sort of the end times where you live at your life, how you live.
Right. Judgment, right.
It's just the whole thing is laid out symbolically.
And this is that website that you've been...
Stedman.
Ray Stedman. The as you go through and look at those various concepts of taking a making a spiritual application of something in the natural world, you got to be careful because you can very easily spiritualize things and wind up saying something the Bible doesn't say. But if you think about, look at this idea. There are several terms that have great meaning to us: sheep, fish. You know, we've all been in valleys, and of course the fountain. And we all know what dung is. And while you try not to think about that, if you're living in a city with walls, you'd be very grateful that somebody had thought about that so that you're not living in your own refuse. So everything had been taken care of. There's an order to everything. And even in the midst of chaos, you see that God is ordering the lives of His people, and He's giving Nehemiah the leadership to help do that. But think about, look at this terrain. I mean, we're talking about, it wouldn't be very easy to build in this area. Very rocky, very dangerous. This is tough, gritty work. Now, why does all this happen? I want to skip over to chapter 4 real quick for you to see. What does Nehemiah say was their success? Did any of you watch the Super Bowl last night? You're going to be shocked. I did not. I found out who won this morning, I was told. You watched it? It was good? Yeah, I didn't watch it. I chose to sleep through it. I was sleeping. I have been given I wasn't given it. My insurance company paid for it. A CPAP machine. And so I'm hooking myself into this, you know, looks like I'm fixing to go get in a jet airplane and fly somewhere and going to sleep. And so I slept through the thing. But everybody was very happy this morning. And as you know, our culture, somewhere along the way, someone, the MVP of the game was the quarterback. You know, he's going to get interviewed by somebody, and they're going to be asking him, well, how'd you do it? What was the key to your success? Well, Nehemiah kind of has that same thing happen, except he's not being interviewed, but he does tell us, and I want you to see that. It's in chapter 4. It's in chapter 4, verse 6. And if you read very quickly, you read over it and you don't see it. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height. So that's what I was thinking of when you asked me about the towers a while ago, Jeff. You know, everything is, right now, we're just getting it to, you know, belt high kind of. And all the wall was joined together half its height, for the people had a mind to work. And as we go back and look at our outline for chapter 3, I think it's really important that we hold that in view. Everybody's building the wall. The community's rebuilding the wall. This is a group effort. And the reason it's going to work is because everybody, the community, had a mind to work. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, you got to start. You can't. Yeah, we're starting. We're still in this. It's a big thing. And think about that. I don't know if you've ever built a wall. I have. You're happy when it's halfway up. I mean, you know, because you're no longer bending over and you're back. Yeah, I mean, that's a great thing when it gets here. Of course, now when it gets here, there's other issues involved, but that's a wonderful time. Right. Right. Yeah, they're just getting going. And but he's telling us why it's so successful. Everybody's working. Everybody's pulling together. And now let's apply that to church. I'm certain that in your church, like my church, you have a group of people who do most everything, that another group of people who do very little. And we even have given that a name. We call it the 80-20 rule. That in church work, 80% of the people do nothing, 20% of the people do everything. 20% of the people give, 80% of the people give nothing. There's this 80-20 rule. And that's sad. And the reason it's that way, though, is our people don't have a mind to work. It's all about our attitude. And the reason this is so successful, but you got to understand, look what God had to do to get this people to have a mind to work. I mean, a terrible price had been paid. Yeah. I mean, they've been in bondage in Babylon for 70 years. Before that, they had watched their northern cousins all be taken away into captivity by Assyria and lost to history. That would get your attention, wouldn't it? I would hope it would. I would say, I guess, if that didn't get our attention, then probably nothing would, right? And in America, we haven't had that kind of problem. We're still in that Amos category where we're laying on beds of ivory. We're at ease in Zion, he said. So that's kind of where we are still, even though things are starting to get a little shaky for us. So that I think that's important as we look at this chapter 3. But yes, Lee, each gate. Right. Yeah. No, it's a mind, right. Yeah, none of us have, you know, if you're waiting a year perfectly ready to do something, you'll never do anything. Yes, right, exactly. Well, I was just telling you, Robert Moore was the one digging the ditch down there today. That I was leaning on the shovel for him when I held it up for him. It's all about attitude. And I know what Robert's age is, and I remember in Bardstown, there were four guys who hung around the church and did work. And they would have mowed my grass if I'd let them because I lived in Parsonage. And I had two young sons who needed something to do. And so I refused to allow them to mow my grass, because I wanted Aaron and Joel to do it. And every once in a while, Mallory, a couple of those guys, they'd come by and say, "I saw them out there mowing. You was right. They need something to do." You know, because they'd never done anything. And you think about it as a little boy, if you're trying to teach someone to work, I mean, you literally have to be taught to work. And when the whole community gets involved in working, that's a wonderful time. Because the young and the old are together, and much is being taught back both ways. It's just a great opportunity. And we miss it today, particularly in churches, because most of our churches today, if we're going to build something, we hire it done. And when we hire it done, we're really robbing ourselves of a lot of blessings. Now, I understand there's other things, but that's a fact. Okay, look, if you will, in chapter 3 about the horse gate, verse 28. Above the horse gate, the priest repaired each one opposite his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, repaired opposite his own house. After Shemaiah, the son of Jeconiah, the keeper of the east gate, repaired. After him, Hananiah, the son of Shemaiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zalpha, repaired another section. I just want you to see, they're repairing next to their houses too. So they've got a vested interest in this all the way around. They're not just building a gate for God's glory. They're also building a gate because, hey, this is next to my house. So everybody has a vested interest in this thing. And I think that has something to do with their having a mind to work. You know, so giving people a reason, you know, we today talk about ownership, a stake in when we make the decisions. That's important too. Yes, yes. And that's very strange that a woman's name would be mentioned. So either he was very important, or she did some kind of extraordinary work. Because the ladies, I think, isn't that not the only name outside of queens that are mentioned in here? I don't think there's other evidence of a woman being mentioned. Let's see here. Look at chapter 3, the last verse and then the first verse. So, in between the upper chamber of the corner of the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. And then look at chapter 4, verse 1. We're not going to go there today, but now when Sanballat heard they were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. So, they get it half high, or they get it together, and automatically, once more, here comes this opposition. And boy, are they able to get us. I wanted to look and see. Come on. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find my copy of your book, Nehemiah, Mr. Wearsby's book. It's on here. Because there was something in chapter 3. If you'll look at his book there, in his chapter 3, I'm not yet there. Yeah. This is I don't know what page this would be on. He talks about Tekoa, and I had mentioned earlier about the Tekoites built the wall, but their nobles refused. You remember that? Some people will not work, Nehemiah 3:5, which we were talking about. Tekoa was a town about 11 miles from Jerusalem, and some of their people traveled to Jerusalem to assist in the work. Thank you. Forty-nine. Okay. But this is something that we don't often see, and I just wanted to point it out. We're mistakenly thinking that this whole wall was built by the Israelites. But these people from Tekoa, they haven't necessarily returned with Nehemiah. And the Gibeonites, all these other areas. But notice the difference, and this is something I think often we miss, and why I wanted to point it out. We talked about the 80% who won't do anything. Sometimes is it not possible for us to let those folks get in our way? Yeah. But I want you to see, none of that's happening here. Even though we think that it looks like all the community's working and it's a great thing, you still got some folks in Tekoa at least, and I'm sure there's some other places, that think they're too good to help. But they're not allowed to stop it. Even though, now Sanballat's going to be giving active opposition. This might be passive opposition, but none of it's allowed. They just keep working.
Verse 3, chapter 4, verse 26. Now, Tobiah, an Ammonite, was by him, and he said, even they which built the wall, if a fox go up on it,
Yeah, any kind of criticism they can give, they want to. That's right. But they're. But I think sometimes I just wanted, as I was reading through his notes, I thought, you know, those aristocrats, and he goes on to make the point how that Paul was a tent maker and that Jesus was a fisherman, and that, you know, we all need to worry about what we can do, but we all can do something, no matter if it's our specialty. And I just thought that had, when we're talking about church work, particularly when you get on the mission field, you find out much of what we think and how we think here is just so wrong.
My husband and I have a school in a church in Haiti.
Yes.
And when the earthquake came, it demolished almost every bit of the building. And we went back last summer, and people had pretty much, once this happened to them, they were just really depressed, and they stopped doing anything around the church. We were doing a revival there that week, and my husband preached. There was another preacher with us, and my husband preached the first night of the revival, and he told the people, he said, you know, you've got to get up and move. You know,
right.
Some of the church members that had lost their, sure. The pastor had lost his wife in the earthquake, and there were some other church members that had died. But he told them, he said, you know, you need to rebuild. And so, they set a date, I think it was on Wednesday, you know, to come out and to work. And it's built out of cinder blocks. And so
right.
It's hard to work with cinder blocks.
Right.
And so the next morning, when we got there about 10 o'clock because in other third world countries, the travel is very difficult. And so we got there maybe 10, 11 o'clock where the whole church was there. And he told the people, he said, whatever you've got at home to work with, to bring. And so we got there, and they were already working. And it was pitiful in the sense of the things that we have to work with. They had those 5-gallon plastic buckets. They had aluminum dish pans, just anything that would hold some rocks. And they made this line, like assembly line,
mm-hmm.
And they begin to move, and we passed those rocks, and we worked all day on that building. And you wouldn't believe, you know, we had some men with picks and shovels that were breaking up the cinder block. But after the day was over, we were all exhausted, but, you know, it was a lot of fun, you know, to work with these people and to see. I mean, there were little children that could barely walk there, but yet everybody was doing their share of throwing the rocks.
And that's a problem with us. We miss that word community.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get together for whatever reason, and we talk about when we go on mission trips, you get a group of people together, you have a sense of Christian community for a week. We really miss that in the States because we're a very isolated nation. You know, the community I live in, you know, you drive in, you hit your little button, and your garage door goes up, and you drive in your garage, and it goes down, and nobody knows anybody. And, of course, everybody knows me, and they keep moving.
But it was amazing to see, you know, everybody showed up.
Right.
And everybody worked, and nobody quit until, you know, everybody was...
And that's the thing that's happening here. The people are going together. And like when Emerson built the building that it now has, 10 years ago that happened. I hope that it will happen again as we work on these trailers. But you never know. Because sometimes you try something like that, and because of the people not having a mind to work, you wind up with another group of people who are doing it all and who are frustrated and get mad, and you have issues. So it all depends on the people. What? Oh, we did. We did. Yeah. But that whole concept, when you're building a building or you're doing anything for church, you always run that risk. It can be a blessing, but it can also be a curse. You know, we never know because God's dependent on us, and it's how we choose to react. Nehemiah overcame a lot of adversity, and I think sometimes as we read Nehemiah, we kind of gloss over that because he had a successful outcome. The losing quarterback last night, I guarantee you, still a pretty good quarterback. Yet today he will be the goat and the other guy the hero. And if you were starting a team, you probably could, you know, you could probably use a quarterback like the losing quarterback last night.
They already asked the winning one, what are you going to do now?
Right. Go to Disney World? Yeah, yeah. I think they get paid to say that.
They were advertising.
Yeah, they're very good at that. Right. Anybody else have anything out of your book, out of Dr. Wearsby's notes that you want to share? That right.
And these guys, and I'm probably mispronouncing the names, but the work crew of Shalom, son of Eliki.
What verse are you in?
This is just a note on 3:12.
Okay.
And he says that possibly he had no sons.
Right.
His family still pushed through the work, through the labor of his daughter. So.
That's probably the reason why the daughters are mentioned. That's usually the only reason. And that's sad, but that's how it is. And you know, so often I think people get upset with the Old Testament in that way, and many have invented a thing called radical feminism. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Many of you ladies would be greatly offended if I were to tell you much about it. I won't tell you much. Well, I was doing some work for my last degree here. I had to do a whole study of that, and I had to read a lot of their writings. And invariably, what would start women down that road was the fact that either they had been abused by a man, or they had grown up in some situation where men who were supposed to carry out their divine responsibilities and protect them didn't do it. And what happens is they take that problem with a man and they push it on God the Father and say, well, all men are that way. And then they go to the Old Testament and they find all these instances where men are mentioned and where women are nothing. And they say, see, I told you so. And the reality is, if you were reading any book of this age, regardless of its spiritual text or not, this is just how the ancient world dealt with women. It was very, very wrong, but that's how it was. And so a lot of people have taken that and used it to start a really terrible thing. Yeah, you'd be right there going with it, but your name wouldn't have got written down. Would have been how great Lee was. Yeah. Yeah. How wonderful Lee Sneed was and his two sons. But you and Pam, y'all would have not been mentioned. And you'd have been right there working just as hard or harder. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's how it was. Unfair, yes, but that was the culture. And if you go into that part of the world today and you look at the Islamic culture, that's how it is. That's why in Iran they're going to stone this lady or whatever, you know, they don't think of her. And they tell you that they'll stone the man too, but I haven't found an instance of that occurring. That'd be pretty big news if they did that. And I think John chapter 8, Jesus pretty well covered how that's going to be. If you're going to stone one, you need to stone them both. But then the one who's without sin should throw the first stone, and I think that would end it. So. Well, all right, let's break now for our vittles, and we'll come back and jump in Mark and hopefully do some catch-up. And remember, we're going to start with our discussion of Mark about Elijah and John the Baptist, and see what we can find out about who's what there. So let's ask God's blessing on our snack. Father, just bless this time together. Bless our food and bless those who have prepared it, and help us all to learn, open our minds, and help us to think so that we can find that truth in Your Word that we need to apply to ourselves and teach to others. This we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.